We're back with Greg Mitchell, Jim Simard, and Dan Fruits here on Juno Afternoon, all three of whom worked on the scenic elements of the Princess Sophia opera opening this Thursday. We've got pictures online of all three of you, each with your craft. You can check those out at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Jim, we've got a picture of you working on what appears to be a stuffed dog. Is that what I think it is?
Yeah, it's pretty amusing picture, isn't it? There is a dog in this story. He's a character and is represented by a puppet of a dog. So we've worked with a plush toy, and I'm the puppet creator. We've articulated him so that he can swim. It was a pretty fun job. My partner in that has been my grandson, Sterling, and we're pretty pleased with the dog.
And Dan, we've got a sample of your work as well as one of you in your studio.
Yeah.
Personally, I loved your exhibit. I thought it was such a terrific.
You saw the exhibit at City Museum?
Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful rendering of the tragedy. Panel by panel, you absorb it like you would absorb a storyboard or even a graphic novel, but in more of a classic style maybe. How would you describe your artistic style or the style of these paintings?
I have trouble answering that. I should have some pat answer so it'd be clear. Expressionistic, I care a lot about surface. I care a lot about the shapes. The shapes of the thing is as important as the content. The content sometimes in my work is secondary. That as soon as this show's over, I start a new set of work that's going to be quite abstract. It's going to be an Arctic voyage. It's going to have ships and snow and storm in it, but it's inspired by the opera. But it's going to be quite more abstract than some of this work.
And what are you doing here in your studio in this picture?
I'm standing there. Katie's in there taking pictures of some of the work, and it looked like I'm kind of dumbfounded. I have no idea. I have no idea what I'm doing there.
I think it looks like you're explaining.
My hands are doing something, aren't they? I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing.
All of the originals that were on display in the City Museum, were those sold?
A lot of them been sold. There's going to be some of the original work in the lobby at the auditorium on display. There's going to be 10 pieces, and some of them are already sold, but there's some available if there's interest, yeah.
And what's the title of this work here, the one that we have a photo of?
That one's sort of the key. What the ship did is it got on the rock and sat there and weathered the storm for 24 hours. Then the storm got terrible, and it did a 180, and that's where it's getting ready to go off backwards. It sinks backwards. It was facing the other direction when it hit the reef. Then it spun around and slid off backward. That's beginning the slide. And there's talk about the boilers exploding, and there's an indication of some of that going on in it.
You know, I should mention there that some of the production crew has been able to get out there on the reef. And I know Dan has and climbed around on the rocks to really try to get a sense of the place and the event.
What was that experience like?
It was – were you with us that day?
No, that day.
David and I I've been to a lot of places where tragedies happen, battlefields, Civil War battlefields, and there's a sense of awfulness. You feel the awfulness that happened there. I expected to feel it on standing on Vanderbilt Reef, but the land's actually quite close by, and it was, of course, a beautiful day when we were there, and a mid-tide. Spooky to think that 353 people lost their lives in a horrible manner. That ship was pounded on for hours. It must have been horrific.
And I'm sure they all thought they were going to get rescued at some point, being out there for so long.
That was the first 24 hours, yes.
It's hard to imagine, but when you try, it's you know, it really gets you. And it was the actual anniversary is this week, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
So they would have been kind of getting ready to set sail, I think, yesterday. We talked about it a little bit.
They would have left Skagway late yesterday, about 10 o'clock in the evening, yeah.
100 years ago, on a day maybe kind of like today, stormy, bad visibility, rough seas. Any more you'd like to say about the story behind the story of the paintings?
I just tried to find significant parts of the story without making them illustration, making them artwork. I don't know if people understand that or not, but that they can stand on their own, that they have a life. But I picked significant moments. There are four pictures. There's two that precedes this and one that follows it. And then one where the ship is underwater. That's one of the very last parts of the ship.
Will your paintings ever be on exhibit all in the same place again?
I think there gets the sadness of being a painter is that you sell things and they go off and you don't get to see them again.
That is part of the business.
And already this series is getting scattered, yeah.
Well, congratulations on selling them. That's a big accomplishment. Well. And they will live on in the opera. And finally, Greg, you're the you do projection design. Is that the right title?
Yes.
Okay. So we've got a photo of you with at least four projectors. what was the challenge of projecting someone else's art?
Well, the projection part has different challenges than the art. We needed to figure out a way that we could get images that were bright enough to work with the stage lights and that could fill the amount of space that we needed to around a set and around performers. So there's a lot of technical work that goes into figuring out how you can get the right sort of projectors in the right place and control them. The projecting the art itself is such a joy. I spend a lot of time manipulating the art digitally in the computer and figuring out how it will display on the screen. One thing to note, for example, is Dan's paintings are of a completely different shape and aspect ratio than our projection surface.
Oh.
So we make a lot of choices about how we're going to cut up Dan's paintings or how we'll manipulate them. And oftentimes, we don't necessarily want to stare at a painting with a lot of information as the background to an opera for a long time because Dan's paintings are so enticing that you just want to look at them and not necessarily the other things. So there are a lot of times when we take his paintings and cut them up into pieces or manipulate them to completely change the color schemes, the textures of them, invert them. Or sometimes one of my favorite things we've done is zoom in incredible detail. We've taken a very high-resolution imagery of Dan's paintings, and I've been able to zoom into tiny corners of the paintings and find the most beautiful brush strokes and textures, and you might zoom into a painting of the ship with the passengers and find an Alaskan sky, or you might zoom in on waves and they turn into mountains. So a lot of what we've done is actually have them moving and find different parts of them and then only periodically reveal the painting as a smaller piece up on the screen. I guess the biggest challenge is to decide how often we want to see one of Dan's paintings in its entirety and how often we want to get at the mood or the emotional resonance of a particular scene or piece of music in something that's chosen from it. I've worked exclusively, except for one point at the end, which I won't give away, exclusively with only Dan's paintings. So even when things become a raging storm or moving violently or textures, it's still all based in Dan's paintings. And sometimes that's a case of taking two or three paintings, cutting them up digitally so you can still sell them, and actually overlaying them with differing layers of opacity and manipulation so they look like entirely different things, sea foam or ice, blinding ice moving, that sort of thing.
That is intriguing. I think what's interesting about this play is that we all kind of know how it ends. So what people are going to see is the choreography, the singing, and the set.
The art.
So if I wasn't intrigued before, I was now. Can you tell us why you need four projectors?
Yes. It has to do with the amount of illumination we need. And these are no ordinary projectors. They are laser projectors. So they project an incredibly high color fidelity to get the subtlety of Dan's paintings. And they do it with incredible detail. We need four together because the sheer amount of power you need to project that much light through the painting and live with the stage lighting so it doesn't get washed out requires that. There are projectors that could do it as one projector, but they are very expensive and they use a lot of power and getting in the theater is tricky. We had to get these projectors, even the four of them, from Seattle. So we also had the problem of having a projector that could fly in a plane. Many more powerful projectors would have to come up on a barge, and that would blow away our time horizon and also cost. So what we've done is we've taken four projectors with extreme long-throw high-definition lenses. We've divided our surface up into four pieces, and all four projectors blend together through digital software to create one very bright image that can fill the entire stage. And the entire projected surface is about 40 feet wide by 20 feet tall.
What is the material of the surface?
Well, the material is what's called scrim, and this is something that Jim and I talked quite a bit about what to project onto. We had many different thoughts, but they actually JDHS actually owned a scrim, which is a piece of material used to reveal other objects behind it. If you light a scrim in certain ways, it appears completely opaque, and you could put color on it. If you light behind it, it appears transparent. So it's a woven fabric with lots of holes in it. This turned out to be a beautiful projection surface because the scrim will pick up the projections very nicely and impart some texture into them, so they already look interesting. But we have a black curtain behind them, and that means that we have a lot of control over the value of the projection. We can begin to take projection away, and it reveals the black curtain behind it, so you get intense black and really beautiful highlights out of it.
Thank you. Gosh, I could talk all day about that alone and about all of the scenic elements of this opera. We are just about out of time. One question, though, we've been asking everyone. I don't have time to ask you all. I'm going to direct it to Jim. Everyone who's come through the Princess Sophia, come through our studios and been interviewed by us about the Princess Sophia, we've asked them, what is this opera to you?
Oh, man. Well, in the first place, it's a chance to work with some of my old friends, Dan and Dave Hunsaker in particular. I've been doing theater work for a long time, and David and I have done productions going back many years. So that's a big thing to me. And it's a chance for me to work collaboratively with the whole community of artists who are doing this. So that's the nature of theater work, is it's a collaborative work.
Jim Simard, Dan Fruits, and Greg Mitchell, all three involved in the scenic elements of The Princess Sophia. It opens this Thursday, 8 p.m. There's also a show on Saturday and Sunday. Tickets are available at Hearthside Books, Jack, and online. And we don't want to forget there's pay-as-you-can tickets available on Saturday and Sunday, so you can inquire at your vendor on how to
Show up at the door.
Show up at the door. There you go.
And
thanks,
come
Jim.
Early.
And it'll be at the Juno Douglas High School Auditorium. Lots of luck to you. Thank you for doing this. It's just such an amazing event that 100 years later, we have this desire to commemorate it in this huge way. So thank you all for your work on this
production.
Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you.